Hey guys. So for those of you who've been listening to us for the past couple weeks or even months, you'll know that we typically start each episode with a trailer. And what this trailer is, it's a chance for us to use some sound design, some texture, quotes, and clips to try and bring you into the story. You know, we're about telling stories and we want to transport you to a different place, to transport you to the story. Because that's what we're about. Here at Real Vision, we want to tell you an interesting story about the financial markets. But today, we don't need to do that because we're not telling you a story. And we're not telling you a story because we have a hedge fund legend on the show. Now, the word legend gets thrown around a lot, but for us, we make no exaggeration when we say that we have an absolute legend with us. But hold that thought in your head because it gets better. Now, we all know an interview is only as good as the interviewer. And so imagine if one of the greatest hedge fund managers was interviewed by one of the legends in the industry as well. And that's what we have this week. And best of all, we get a front row seat. So this week on Adventures in Finance, Kyle Bass interviews John Burbank. All right, James, hit it.
Also coming up in this week's episode, we have our traditional long short segment where Aaron and I discuss the good and the, of course, not so good stories of the week.
The assets under management in GDXJ represent around 20% of the $30 billion universe of junior miners. What that's resulted in is the index having to now think about expanding the possible universe of miners to include in the index. And so in this sense, I'm short GDXJ, but I'm actually long the miners that are going to be included in the index eventually.
My short this week is Netflix, which announced their results yesterday, and wow, man, there were some numbers in there that just defy belief. When we all know what the stock's done, it's just been one of the best performers in the US for a few years now. But what really caught my eye was the fact that they have $14.5 billion of commitment to produce original content.
And finally, in a favorite segment of ours called Things They Got Wrong, we speak with a market expert about something they got wrong and ask them to share a pearl of investing wisdom with the benefit of 2020 hindsight.
Yeah, so this week we spoke with the extremely energetic John Netto, founder of the Protean Trader and author of the new book Global Macro Edge. And John talked about what he got wrong in his preparation. I'm Grant Williams.
I'm Aaron Chan, and this is Adventures in Finance. So today is April 20th, 2017, and welcome to episode 12 of Adventures in Finance. And to my right is producer James. How are you, James?
Not too bad, Aaron. How are you doing?
Well, it's been a really interesting day. An interesting couple of 12 hours. The UK called a snap election. Did you hear about that?
Was it like snappy?
No, it wasn't snappy. It had nothing to do with Snapchat. But a decision that was not made snappily is Grant Williams coming back to the Cayman Islands. Grant, for the first week out of 12 weeks, I haven't had to ask you where you are in the world. That's
yeah, you're
amazing.
Right. I'm right here, which means that to my left is James, which is perhaps not ideal, but here we are.
I think the average age in the room just rose about 50 years.
I think it's funny how we're also arranged in ascending or descending age. I wonder if that happened by accident.
Why don't we move off the age discussion and get on to this week's podcast? I think that's the smartest move.
But Grant, before we dive right in, for those of our listeners who are paying attention, you may have noticed that we didn't have one of James's elaborate soundscapes in the beginning.
Yeah, I was a little bit disappointed about that.
I'm actually a little sad for you, James, because you have this really cool looking, got blue lights, purple lights. It's like this UFO looking keyboard on your desk.
I brought it in specially to use, and then you guys give me nothing,
James,
nothing to do.
I've told you, we are not having the Beverly Hills Cop theme tune in the podcast.
Wait, was that on the company's budget?
No.
All right. Well, we didn't have a soundscape this week for a very good reason, because we have Kyle Bass and John Burbank.
Yeah, Kyle went to San Francisco to interview John. And what we ended up with was a conversation between two real investing giants that just contained so much insight and so much incredible depth of thought. We thought it'd be a great chance to run through some of that with you guys today.
Yeah, I can't say how many times I've watched that interview. But before we get to that, first up is our long short segment where Grant and I go through the good and not so good stories of the week. Grant, do you want to start or should I start this one? Because my long and short, I kind of took this from your book.
Ah,
I combined
them. You're going to pull the old two for one, aren't you?
Yes.
All right, well, look, why don't I start with my short this week? My short this week is Netflix, which announced their results yesterday. And wow, man, there were some numbers in there that just defy belief. When we all know what the stock's done, it's It's just been one of the best performers in the US for a few years now. But when reading these reports, I mean, the company missed their net ads for streaming domestically. They missed their net international streaming ads. Their forecast EPS is 8 cents below where it was before. But what really caught my eye was the fact that they have $14.5 billion of commitment to produce original content baked into their numbers.
What's their market cap?
You know what? I'm not even sure what the market cap is now. It's astronomically above where it should be.
That's ridiculous.
But they burned $422 million in cash in the first quarter, and they expect to burn a total of $2 billion, just burning it in the for this year. And a couple of quotes from the thing, which were just amazing. The CFO said that they want to grow their operating margins slowly so that they can spend enough to quickly grow revenue and original content. They anticipate free cash flow to accompany They expect negative free cash flow to accompany their rapid growth for many years to come. Now, you know, if you've bought into this thing, it's extraordinary. But the thing that to make me laugh at the end, the silver lining, according to the Leicester shareholders, was that they continue to promote their tie-up with Adam Sandler. And this is what they said. Just ahead of the release of our third film from Adam Sandler, Sandy Wexler, we announced the renewal of our deal with Sandler to premiere an additional 4 films exclusively on Netflix around the world. We continue to be excited by our Sandler relationship, and our members continue to be thrilled with his films. Here we go. Since the launch of The Ridiculous Six, Netflix members have spent more than half a billion hours enjoying the films of Adam Sandler. Now, I took the liberty of going to Rotten Tomatoes or Rotten Tomatoes, depending on where you're listening to this through, to get a couple of reviews for Sandy Wexler. And a couple stood out. Here's the first one from The Hollywood Reporter. As with almost every Sandler vehicle, this is an adoring ode to a lifelong man baby who mistakes his half-assed excretions for art. There were a couple of even less complimentary ones. Once again, the actor is pathetic. Once again, the actor is pathetic and the movie is gross. And just when you thought Sandler couldn't embarrass himself any further, he drops the laughless mess known as Sandy Wexler. Now, this is the plus side for Netflix's they've doubled down on this relationship. So me, I don't see anything in there that makes me want to be long Netflix. So that's my short for the week.
Wow.
I went on quite a long time.
But it is one of those stories that you read, especially if you dive into the details,
astounding. You know, it speaks to the ETF phenomenon. It speaks to herding. It speaks to all the things that we know on a macro level are wrong with markets right now. And I suspect when we get any kind of correction that Netflix is going to be the first one that's taken out the back and hit with a stick.
So what you're saying there, Grant, is that Netflix has released 2 Adam Sandler movies in the time it's taken for me to wait for the next House of Cards installment. That's crazy.
Well, hey, listen, 500 million hours of watching Adam Sandler movies.
But who cares? I mean, who cares about those numbers? You and I get to binge on these amazing films and shows that Netflix has. You mentioned the markets.
That's
and
fine.
All that.
Hey, but look, buy a subscription. Just don't buy the shares.
Yeah, I guess. But I think what it also speaks to at a societal level is just this. I mean, who in their right mind would binge or watch that much Adam Sandler?
Well, just think, James, put your hand down. Just think what benefits the world may have missed out on in that 500 million hours. You know, any one of those people that added up to 500 million hours could have, you know, invented a cure for something like bad production, for example.
Yeah, but I don't think people who are binging on Netflix are in any position to cure anything.
That may be a good point. Anyway, that's my short for the week. What's I guess you give us your long and short.
Yes, I'm going to do the 2-for-1. And this story, it's interesting because it weaves together the indexation, so the passive money story, and also gold miners, which is a favorite of mine.
You are owning that space.
Yes. And so since 2016, and this is actually about the GDXJ ETF.
Which about this story. I'm glad I didn't take it.
Yeah, I just had to jump on this one because it's fascinating, really, being a past investor in GDXJ. But since 2016, the beginning of 2016, the assets under management have more than tripled from $1.5 billion to $5.5 billion, to the point where now the assets under management in GDXJ represent around 20% of the $30 billion universe of junior miners. Now, that oversteps the SEC's concentration limit of 20% ownership, especially if you're a passive investor. And what that's resulted in is the index having to now think about expanding the possible universe of miners to include in the index. And so in this sense, I'm short GDXJ, but I'm actually long the miners that are going to be included in the index eventually, because according to certain reports, they are going to start investing in significantly larger companies. So increasing the size of it from around 30 billion to 70 billion. And BMO even said that GDXJ would add roughly 18 new components in June when they rebalance the index. And they'll cut in half some of their other holdings, about $3 billion worth. So for those, I mean, if you want to do the research and see which companies might be included in the index come June, might be a good long and maybe short the index.
Yeah, look, this is fascinating to me on many levels. I mean, I gave a presentation in December of 2015 called Nobody Cares, just talking about how little it would take of inflows into this sector to really move things in the right direction. And this is the first sign that that's happening. It also speaks on the negative side to the problems with passive management and ETFs.
Right.
And we are going to start to see this happen, I think, where the ETFs get too big for the market, and particularly the ones that are in illiquid underlyings, and more dangerously, the fact that we have these triple leveraged ETFs. So you saw this week that the direction of cancel creation of the triple long gold miners ETF for that exact reason. We're just reaching the bounds where they can't physically create these things because the liquidity isn't there.
Yeah.
And that liquidity problem is going to come home to roost, I expect. That just leaves my long. We've taken a lot of time walking through this. So I'll just quickly, my long is the US Treasury market. And it's very simple. The macro data is starting to deteriorate. The hard data is starting to catch up with the soft data. And I see so many of these jaws charts, as Steph Bomboy
calls them. Soft data, hard data.
Just the jaws open up. And invariably, these things tend to catch up with the high one, fall into the low one. And that tells me that we're in for a period of some bad macro data. And I think people are going to want to own treasuries again.
Yeah. Well, if you've been following the podcast, we did the reflation story a couple of weeks back, and you'd already be hip to the bond trade, perhaps. So.
Listen,
I don't want to take credit, but
at my age, the word hip is normally followed by the word operation. So let's just try and keep that out of it, shall we, for now?
All right, sounds good. Well, Grant, let's move on to the commentary feature for this week. And this week we have a masterclass between two legends in the hedge fund industry. We have Cal Bass's interview with John Burbank that was published back in March of 2015. That's over 2 years ago. I mean, this is before I even knew about Real Vision, but If this was a short book or some kind of article, I would have tons of annotations, highlights, and dog-eared pages. It's a truly timeless interview for the intellectually curious investor and, you know, anyone who wants to learn from the best in the business.
Yeah, these two guys really are best in breed. And you know, not only are they super smart money managers, but they're just terrific guys, you know, very generous with their time. And I obviously saw the footage at the same time everybody else here at Real Vision. I wasn't there when the recording happened. And it was just fantastic to see two guys with this level of intellect sit and talk. And I was fascinated by the questions that Kyle asked, because we didn't guide him in any way. It was basically, hey, the interview's yours. You ask the questions you want to ask. And so the questions were insightful. The answers equally so. So let's get to it.
Yeah, I think, you know, for the average investor who doesn't get access to these people normally, it's incredible amounts of information that's in one of these interviews, not just, as you say, about the views on the world, but it's also about how they think about things, how they invest, you know, that the portfolio construction, all the things that really make you a good investor. And we're lucky enough to have some of the world's best investors on these podcasts from Real Vision Television and our archives. I think it's great.
Well, you and I have been very fortunate that we get to spend time with a lot of these guys and sit down and really pick their brains about the things that we want to know, what makes them great investors. And that was a big part of starting Real Vision, is to try and get more people to hear that knowledge, share those ideas, and really understand what it is that makes someone a truly great investor.
Yeah, I think it's an important point, Grant. The reason we started this, as you say, is we wanted to give people a broader access to actually what goes on in the financial markets. Because I think the media let many people down back in 2008 and certainly in the periods before that. And I think it was really crucial to us to bring all of the smartest people we knew and get them to talk freely and openly about financial markets and how they invest. I think that's been a really powerful thing. The great thing here is we've got two of the world's most famous investors, Kyle Bass and John Burbank, in conversation with each other. So it wasn't even you and I talking to them.
Yeah, which is better, obviously. Yeah,
obviously. And what was incredible is how they approached the discussion, the depth they went into almost immediately. I think the amount of nuanced learning from this is just astonishing, because these guys are super smart. They both run multi-billion dollar portfolios. They're both incredibly successful, have amazing track records, and are highly regarded within the industry. So I think it's just a gem from our archives.
Well, what do you say you and I shut up and we let people listen to the real smart guys talk?
All right. So what I want to do, John, is I'm going to start right where I'm really interested, and we can work back to where it's slightly less interesting, if that's possible.
Okay.
I'm curious to know how, when you work up to a conviction level on one of your most exciting ideas, how do you conceptualize with your team, and how do you think about sizing a position, and how do you really make things, quote, count? What's a large position for you in percentage of your fund? I realize you have your kind of master fund, and then you have some highly concentrated best ideas funds from talking to you before, but say in your primary vehicle, how do you think about sizing both long and short kind of best ideas?
Blimey, that didn't take long. My first interjection. I love that Kyle jumped in immediately with a question on trade sizing. Barely, hey, John, how are you? Straight on to, how do you size trades? I think it's clearly, it was top of his mind. And I know when from running a hedge fund in my days of old that it is one of the single most important things, and everybody's terrified
it's
of getting
the most
it wrong.
To me, it's the most important thing. And the fact that you picked that, I mean, it makes me laugh, because when I interviewed Kyle again later on, it was the first question I asked him. So, you know, it was so interesting to me that that was where you went, because even the best investors always want to know, is there a better way of doing this? Because it's so crucial.
Yeah, and I think it's amazing that here's two really successful investors, and they clearly don't know everything, but they want to learn from each other. And John is a master of trade sizing. Kyle is a, you know, master of other things. And so they're just trying to figure it out between them. I think it's just brilliant.
Well, when you think about what Kyle's done, particularly with the Japan trade, you know, Kyle's rational investor paradox is one of the best investment cases you'll ever hear. It's a completely closed circle. There's no leaks in it, and yet it hasn't worked. And of course, I'm sure he's got sick and tired over the years of talking about Japan and people saying, well, you know, you were wrong. And obviously you and I know that not being right yet is not exactly the same as being wrong. But he managed to stay in that trade because of how he sized it, because he didn't shoot his bolt. He was able to stay in the trade because he got his sizing right. It's so crucial for people to understand.
I think one of the most incredible people in the world for trade sizing is Stan Druckenmiller. He was famous for it. He could run an enormous number of positions in his portfolio, but when it really mattered, he would be a pig, as he called himself.
That's right, yeah. Get greedy.
Yeah, that's right. Anyway, let's go back to listening to John answer Kyle's questions and see how that discourse continues, because it really is interesting. I think probably the most important single part of this whole interview for me.
So we have three different vehicles. One is best ideas, where the size of the position could go up to 30%. So that has happened several times, but it's because I sized something at under 10 and it grew and it was able to grow. The other two that are managed with a certain vol. I like to say that, you know, there are three disciplines of investing. There's macro, there's bottom up, which is the American, you know, fundamental stock picker world. And then there's quant, which is really a model driven risk management enhanced understanding about volatility, and a much greater discipline in portfolio construction, risk, you know, what could happen without having a clue really as to what macro or bottom up is. So I hired someone in 07 who was a quant, and I thought quants actually started making markets different in 06. I just thought they started trading differently, a lot more noise. And quants had really grown from 2000 into 2007, being long value, short growth. Worked every year into that. Anyway, the point is, how I understand this is more nuanced and developed because I've now spent a lot of time just on non-macro, non-fundamental risk understandings. And it's actually changed how I invest. So now when I think about sizing a position, I think about it in the traditional ways of what things are happening in the world that's driving, let's say, my macro view, and then bottom up what my risk reward assessment is. But as important or most important is what will happen to this kind of, you know, security in this kind of regime that I think we'll be in. Mm. And obviously you learn these lessons of like owning small caps in a bear market, you know, or, but ex ante, you can filter out a lot of these things, illiquidity, et cetera. So all those things go into it. But I think what I've learned also is that portfolio construction of being diversified can be a real benefit to holding these positions too, because when things don't share common characteristics, they'll move in different ways. Mm. And a lot of investing now with short duration capital is the art of holding positions, you know, hedging, holding positions if you can, because so much of what happens to price is simply liquidity moving around. It's not providing a lot of signal. It's a lot of noise. And then, of course, you manage that according to your duration and expectations of your investors. These Chinese internet companies are the most volatile securities that we deal with, mm-hmm. not because there's really doubt about what's going on, but the variety of things, the nature of it, it's Chinese, the uncertainty. I believe that the things that have never happened before are what is how you make real money. Mm. Most people think in a regression of the mean way. They look backwards, extrapolate forwards, and that's what happens 90% of the time. But the signal events, the big things, the things that affect other prices, are things that were not a model, haven't happened before.
Yeah.
So when I'm considering that, I'm trying to consider, no matter how good an idea it could do, I mean, what I've experienced is being ahead of a lot of trends. And
ahead means wrong for a while.
Well, it could be, but also when you're dealing with things that have never happened before, there's a level of uncertainty.
Yeah,
because it's never happened before, you can't model it, and so all you can really do is understand the risk reward of the fertility of the potential of the direction of the magnitude, and so I try to develop a sense of how the world is changing, because again, I think people they don't know how to make sense of chaos, and it's like addressing the complexity of the world. You could say, well, there must be a God, because only a God could understand and create and weave all this complexity together, mm-hmm. as opposed to a Darwinian manifestation of all kinds of factors that are hard to understand. And so I think people are inherently, I think it's unarbitrageable, they're inherently unable to really understand change. So when you think you're investing in something that is not a regression of the mean, goes up to this price to book, then down to that price to book or whatever, there's a lot of uncertainty, and price is not the proper discounting of this new thing. It is merely a reflection of current liquidity.
Yep.
So then the question is sizing according to what you think may happen relative to, with some duration, the risk reward of what could happen. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, if you have a lot of the same bets, then you're increasing your risk dramatically, mm-hmm. with short duration capital, no matter how right you are, because they can go up massively and then down massively.
Yeah.
And the human instinct is to give you more money if it goes up and take it away if you've lost. Because they're trying to make sense of the world.
We've all seen that.
Exactly. And that's just the way it works. So it's a really great question, but there's definitely a tempering. There's a recognition of, it's like you're a cook. You're preparing a dish for a certain kind of audience to how pleasing it'll be not only today, but like almost every day. What combination of other things needed to be there for them to digest it. And different people have different, tolerances and interests. Mm. But the main premise here, though, is that I say price is a liar, meaning price is not telling you the predictive, what's going to happen very well, not nearly as well as people think. And so you have all this opportunity and all this risk inherent in the market, not knowing what's going to happen. Mm. And my proof point is, did 5 years ago in 2009, did the world imagine today? It's like, no way.
No.
And in 2004, could they imagine 2009? Not even close. I mean, the financial bubble was really just really, that's when I started feeling it.
Yeah.
In 99, could you imagine 2004, where you're just about to go into the peak of the housing bubble, in tech? So just work backwards every 5 years and you see 94, could you imagine 99? Like, no.
No.
So I would postulate that in 2014, you have no idea what 2019 is like. It will be extreme changes because liquidity will have to change, positioning will change, facts will emerge, etc. And so the way I look at it is don't overrate the market as to what it knows. understand that what the market is current liquidity, a balancing as many buyers and as sellers. So understand that if you have some sort of edge relative to current liquidity, and if you have the right duration and the right, you know, either tolerance or recipe for how to hold these things,
yeah,
you have an exceptional chance to make money. You also have an exceptional chance to lose money totally against macro or bottom-up rationality, purely because liquidity can go completely against you.
Yeah.
So anyway, but I spent a lot of time trying to understand what's the probabilities of the world being different than the market expects, because that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. How will it be, and when will it be, and you know what are the triggers? And you spent all this time trying to figure those things out.
Wow, I think that was a really profound statement. What is the probability of the world being different to that the market expects? And I think that's really the key to macro.
Yeah.
You know, because we don't live in a world of certainties. What you're looking for is the shifts, and it's the change of probabilities where all the money's to be made. It's not the eventual outcome.
Well, people focus on prices, right? They always say, okay, well, you know, where's Apple going to be next year? Or where's gold? Where's copper going to be? And you're right. What John says there is, I mean, it's just so profound. The idea that you can make money from just handicapping where people are all on one side of the boat, and you think there's a decent pathway that the other side of the boat's going to be where you need, that's where you make the big money.
That's right. I mean, he mentions earlier in the interview about being a contrarian.
Yeah.
And he's saying, you know, don't be a contrarian for the sake of it. You need to be a contrarian when it makes sense to. And that's what he's getting at here, is it's assessing when the probabilities are now skewed towards the market all being wrong, and not just being a dumbass about it and just saying, yeah, everybody's wrong because I'm right.
No, that's it. That's exactly it. And if you can, you know, the great example, you know, you bring up Stan Druckenmiller, and you go back to the famous George Soros bet against the Bank of England. I mean, everybody was on one side of the boat. Soros took a big swing. Well, actually, Stan took the big swing for it. And they made out like bandits. You know, he was a pig at that time. And we've just seen that with the Brexit vote, right? The same thing.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that Kyle has been king of, is the asymmetric bet. And that's kind of implicitly what they're talking about here, is when there's an asymmetry that no probability has been priced in, and it's the pricing in of those probabilities is where all the money's to be made. So, you know, it's the pricing in of heading towards a recession, for example, where the big moves happen. It's not in the recession itself. That's usually the bottom of the trade anyway.
Well, no, the beauty is you don't actually need to be right. You just need more people to come around to your way of thinking. You can be out before you're proven wrong or right. I've made a really good profit and let others who come
absolutely
in late.
Absolutely right.
It's so crucial.
Absolutely right. Anyway.
Let's get back to it, because I know there's just so much more to come.
I've backed into, despite all the issues, the problems that Americans have recognized. 2000, I remember when I started, the Americans were delusional. You know, they thought they owned the whole world. They thought everything was going to grow forever. You know, and then we had top of the market. We had the new 2000 election, which was an incredible event, right? No winner for a month.
Yeah.
And then we've had a series of sort of travesties, you know, really by all forms of government. And now Americans recognize, like, it's not run very well. And right? They understand this. Like kind of all the bad news is out. And there's been massive change. And so it's like a company that's had it's doing a massive turnaround over a long period of time, but we're past the point.
Yeah.
And as much as you can say, hear all the bad things about it,
yeah,
when you go to the competitors, Europe, Japan,
yeah,
or whatever,
yeah,
EM, we're like, my God, we're so primed to do really well.
You're just telling me to just buy anything with yield because it's all going lower.
All right. Okay. Let's stop right there. Now, you heard Kyle there. You know, Kyle said, you're basically telling me to buy anything with yield because it's all going higher. And he said that, you know, this interview was October 2014, which was the beginning of the dollar rally and the beginning of the acceleration phase in the bond market. And it was a time when most people, again, were talking about
Fed tightenings,
right? And this was someone sitting back and saying, okay, I'm listening to what everybody's saying. I'm taking the other side because I've got reasons for it. I have faith in my convictions and I make a very good investment case. And well, guess what? We all know what happened from that point on. And this was something you were talking about very aggressively at the time, this dollar bull market.
Yeah. And what it did, how it caused inflation to collapse globally, the oil price collapse, and obviously yields collapse. And that was what John was referring to, because there was going to be a mad grab for yield as inflation fell, and he got it dead right.
Yeah. And we're still in that now. And you know, I know from a recent conversation I had with John, he's still in that. He still sees that carrying on. But it just shows you, when you get these trends right, you get these big trades right, they can go on literally for years.
And also, What he did do is one of the key things, again, to investing is the knock-on effect, because he saw the dollar rally and extrapolated that into falling yields because inflation is going to fall because the price of oil and commodities is going to fall. And that's the real secret. We talked before about the probability of outcomes. It's understanding how it flows through asset classes and how it develops over time is where you can make real money.
Well, so, the beauty is, the further away, so John sees the dollar as the center peg of this, as you did, and the trigger of it all. But the further away you get from that trade, the less crowded the trades are. Everyone's going, looking at the dollar, they go to oil. But you went to emerging market currencies and John went to emerging market debt. And there are places you go away from the crowd and just kind of front run them and get yourself into a place where you know they're going to come eventually.
Yeah, although there is also a lesson in that, and I've learned it the hard way before, is don't overcomplicate stuff.
Right.
Because sometimes you try and put your hand around the top of your head to scratch your ear when you can just scratch it because it's next to your hand. And you forget that. You kind of construct these complicated portfolios to express a view when really you want the dollar to go up. So, there is a kind of a level of smartness you need to apply to that, but knock-on effects is key.
I'm glad I know now what you're doing and sitting in your office with your head around the really back of your head. Let's go back to Kyle and John.
So I'm basically saying also that GDP growth, so people are attracted to EM for this high GDP growth, but really simple GDP growth is overrated. Expanding plant, okay, the difference between Apple and Apple's, Asian manufacturers, whose business would you rather own? The ones who have to, expand plant to, very competitively make, goods, or the one who designs it, markets it, harvests most of the profit.
Right.
But the GDP of the country that has the manufacturers will grow faster, but the risk they're taking...
It's not very productive to GDP.
Well, it's just, it deserves a lower multiple. It's much riskier.
But it gets a lower multiple. It's just like
it does.
Japan.
It does, but the point is, as the we get older, we have different talents, skills, abilities, ways of monetizing this in a way you can think of the whole world or America as having grown tremendously, and a lot of the rest of the world has not grown that way. So EM is where America was 50 plus years ago, a lot of it. Yeah. I mean, they're in the, we need to grow by using cheap labor or building up plant,
right,
and constructing a competitive reason for that. Whereas we're way farther along just because of having a head start and having a lot of other policies that allow it. And so we've had now this wave of globalization because of China entering the world. Mm-hmm. That's a one-off, never going to happen again. And we've had development of technology that's happening in a way that's very deflationary, I'd say.
It's positively deflationary.
Yep.
Unless you're one of the workers being displaced.
Yep. And you have all these people cyclically thinking the world's going to repeat what it did. This is the problem with the Fed. This is the problem with economists and most model-driven people. They keep expecting the past to repeat. And so when there's different variables, the different hedge fund managers are trying to have a fuzzy model that constantly changes, and part of it's always going to be fuzzy, and you're using part information and part price.
So when you incorporate all of these thoughts, so I agree with many of the things you're saying, how do you position yourself for the next 12, 18 months?
So I've had this position for the last, say, 6-7 months that I'm fully invested and fully hedged. So because I don't know this year that it would do this, right? Until September, it was doing it in that small caps sold off and growth stocks sold off, but the indices didn't.
Yeah.
Anything safe, didn't.
Yeah.
And Treasury's done really well. So it was possible to believe it, but it didn't happen this year. Maybe it would happen next year. That wouldn't have worked. I think the crisis was so positive in changing the delusions of America, American business and boardrooms. It really changed the course of America, but it was overdue for it.
Yeah.
So now I'm so impressed with American companies and American business people. And and that's after spending almost 20 years investing everywhere. Yeah. It's no contest. It's no contest. But when the top guy is delusional and misallocating capital or lazy, it's different than when they're, oh my God, I got to be top of my game.
I gotta be focused.
Yes. Yeah. So I have this view that most of the leading company, not all, but majority are in America.
Okay.
Of what are going to do well. And it's an America that's well along in this reorganization. Expectations have been lowered.
Yep.
But American companies are going global in a way they didn't before the crisis. So I look at the S&P as sort of world beaters that were focused at home, that were a little delusional, and now, like, oh my God, like, this is serious, and this is how I'm going to grow, and I got to do painful, you know, harder things. I got to be smarter. And I look at the rest of the world as having reasons not to go through that process yet, whether you're Japan or Europe or EM, where you just can't actually get the skills that manage them, et cetera. So
fully invested means mostly long U.S.
Yes,
multinationals,
yes,
and big.
Well, it doesn't have to be. It could be leaders. It could
long
be leaders
U.S.
in
leadership.
Could be leaders in tech. It could be leaders in a lot of industries.
And does hedged mean beta or alpha hedges?
It means
are
both.
Are those
short
global?
Things like emerging markets? Short things like commodity equities? Different things. Short. Yeah. It's harder to short obviously bad companies because of all the hedge funds that are already short them, and the correlations that happen. But vol got so low that I decided in July to go to owning puts instead of waging war with a bunch of different small positions.
Yeah.
But trying to formulate where is the leadership going to come from? In a way, I've said I've backed into something where I can now imagine the S&P trading more than 20 times earnings.
Okay, so there's another place that I want to jump in, where John's talking about, you know, I can imagine the S&P trading at 20 times earnings. I mean, there's so much to talk about from that last little piece. And it sounds at face value as though John is a very US-centric cheerleader. It's a, you know, it's a rah-rah, the US is the greatest place to be.
Yeah, but John is, I think you're about to say, is he was really negative on the US for a long time.
Exactly,
he thought it was
exactly
a terrible place to get returns. He loved Asia. And as John's pointing out now, something's shifted. He's seen the macro landscape change entirely.
Well, this idea of being flexible and being willing to look not only across asset classes but around the world for the best ideas. Now, some people don't have the latitude to do that. You know, that makes it much harder. John has that global mandate and he can go where he sees the value. But even in, you know, if you're just a US investor, having the flexibility to move in and out of sectors, in and out of asset classes, it's so important to maintain that.
And also, when you think of the construct that he's coming up with here in this conversation, you can see there's a long and a short.
Yeah.
So he thinks like a hedge fund manager. You know, how do I offset the risk of one trade of being very negative in emerging markets, for example, or oil, or very bullish on bonds? Well, maybe because the US will do better in that environment, better because of the stronger dollar, better because of the tech revolution going there, and all of the other aspects that John, you know, notices is going on in the US versus elsewhere in the world. I think it's really interesting. And it's a key way to think about the long short portfolio idea.
Well, as John puts it, I'm fully invested and fully hedged. You know, it sounds almost flippant, but it's such an important thing to understand.
Because I think if rates are low, the dollar's strong.
Yeah.
Right? You think about it as an investor.
Yeah.
You're losing on.
Well, you're buying a dividend yield, right?
Well, and those yields are higher. You know, I think the yields are so high relative to, you know, Europe or Japan.
Yeah.
But the closest model is the second half of the '90s is what I think can happen, where the U.S. is preeminent, large companies do extremely well, tech as well, but in a very qualitatively superior way to what tech was then. And I think the U.S. becomes the fascination of the world because, in a way, we did all these things that needed to be done, and then the corporations, the stuff that they did and the stuff they didn't do, they're gonna monetize in the future. So it's a lot of things that just are a relative trade of what to be long and what to short to take out your volatility and your risk.
Yeah.
In this case, with a rising dollar, a lot of things are not gonna work. A lot of marginal things are gonna fail. I think you're going to learn, oh my God, that's not a good trade because of price showing you. But I think the best things have a chance of moving down in that liquidity crunch. And after that, when you think that's over, you want to buy basically the S&P, and you want to buy what you think are leading companies. The risk to take is more like tech or biotech or even leading consumer, anything that's leading change, that's causing a leading change is where I'd take my risk. And I don't think the S&P is very risky. So you can take out a lot of that risk by shorting something else.
Yeah.
That's my conclusion.
Okay.
I think the other thing is that where we are in technology is costs of technology have fallen so much. You know, we've never been in this position before. The whole idea of like big data, we've never actually been able to harness the amount of information or data. What we're going to learn from process, being able to process it and using it is going to be extraordinary. You know, the efficiencies are going to be gained. So S&P has already got all-time high margins, totally unexpected. People kept thinking it was going to revert lower. My expectation is the revenue growth is not going to be fantastic because GDP is not going to be fantastic.
Yeah.
Share is going to be gained. Margins have a chance of being higher than you think.
And global share.
Yes, a global share.
Yeah.
And anything pure technology doesn't really care what the rate is. You know, it's either the best and really useful.
Right.
It's not dependent on the euro or dollar exchange rate. So I guess what I'm saying is I think the world has to change from one kind of growth to another. And just because there's QE, you know, putting cash in people's hands, it doesn't actually, you know, cause this change. Right. A lot of the change is really about a displacement of something that's meaningful in the economy with something that's a lot more efficient, whether it's labor or it's CapEx or whatever. You know, yeah. Uber is a good example relative to what was there before. It's just a rearranging right. with information, you know, combination that's really efficient for
massive efficiency,
but a terrible thing for cab drivers who don't change. So that's sort of happening more and more and more.
Yeah.
And I think in Silicon Valley, there's a winner take all reality. You know, people can compete for a niche that's evolving and then someone wins it. And there's usually a number two, but there's no value for anyone else. Hmm. And I think barriers to competition keep coming down around the world. And they're going to keep coming down. And with that, take Japan. If you're not willing to change at the rate that your competition is, you really have a lot more to lose than you used to. You don't have the same barriers. I think the upside on these leading companies where things are changing is higher than is expected. And I think what technology will deliver in margin, in opportunity, in reach, it's really hard to be linear. You can't think linearly. You got to think about what's going to emerge, and it's going to accrete to the guys who cause it and the guys who can scale it before others. So I have this view that American companies are going to win more share than you expect because we change more, we change earlier. And I think that crisis was a fantastic thing,
yeah.
actually, because that was shared throughout the world, but really shared throughout America. Mm. Oh my God, we have to change. The persistence of rationality since the crisis has impressed me. I now think it's going to go for a long time. And if the world doesn't grow that much, you're always in this, not crisis, but this is not easy mode. So I end up having, I despair about Washington, but I've actually completely changed my view of what positive things are going to happen in America. And having invested around the world, I know there's no competition really. So I think you have this opportunity to be short a number of things that are actually riskier than the thing you're long. Uh-huh. And then in a risk-off move, whether it's commodity equity or small caps or whatever, you can do quite well. But I've got a pretty good diversification. I'm in larger to mid cap things, not many small cap. I have a few small caps which have just been driven down. Like I just stopped like buying them or thinking about them because I knew too. The price was wherever,
you know, wherever it was going to go.
Wherever it was going to go.
Yeah.
So that I could say that I could say that I'm probably too higher gross. Usually my gross ends at 200, but the predictability of how it's moved and knowing that I have this downside, like if the market moved up or down a lot, I'd be fine because my puts either, you know, go away. Being short a lot of stock is where you can run into a, you know, real asymmetric
problem.
Yeah, problem.
Yeah.
Okay, I keep jumping in here.
Yeah, it's always you, isn't it?
I know. I'm really sorry about that. I just enjoy listening to these guys.
So no, you enjoy your own voice.
It's been said before, and it'll be said again, I'm sure. This idea that John talked about here, he got oil right, and he was right for a little while. Then he was wrong before he got really right. And that's something that really good investors can do, and poor investors get chased out of trades, or they take money off the table too soon.
Yeah, I had a colleague who used to sit next to me when I was at GLG running the hedge fund, and his expression was, "And thrice ye shall be tested." And it was always the case. You put the trade on, you think it's going to work, then it doesn't work. And it goes, oh, that's painful. Then it works, then it doesn't work. And then finally it works. But it's always, for him, it was always three times you get tested.
Right. But this idea of constantly checking, not just what the price is doing, because, you know, as John said in another interview, price is a liar. Sometimes price doesn't tell you what you need to know. Does the investment case that caused you to put the trade on, does it still hold up?
And that's crucial. I mean, I talk about this a lot, is that people have to do their own homework. Because if you have done your homework, you create your investment thesis, you can stick with it, you understand where you're wrong and why you're wrong, has something changed or not? And then it's down to, back to the beginning, trade sizing. If you're too big, you're going to get knocked out of the trade, or you can't summit the loss. If you've got it right and then it starts working, then you can press your bet.
See, I think this is one of the best things that you can take away from the content on Real Vision is just that. When you've got a trade on, the price may go against you. And what you'll learn from listening to these really smart investors is you have to know what you're doing. You have to know why you're in it, and you can't get talked around and battered.
I just want to interrupt here and say Grant knows from experience, being a complete gold bull, he's had to suffer a couple of years now of some miserable pain.
Yeah, that's very... No, but you know what? This is funny. We joke about it, but it's so true because...
Of course it is.
You know, I haven't been chased out of gold because my position size was okay. And I checked the investment case and I haven't seen a reason for the impetus that gave me the desire to own gold that hasn't gone for me.
And this is part of something that I've talked about a lot before in the past as well, which is about time horizon. If your time horizon, your gold trade is 10 years, then you can't worry about what it does over 2 years, you know, because it's only a fifth of the time. You know, if it's going against you for 10 years, you've probably got it wrong. but otherwise, if the time horizon is crucial and your investment horizon has to match your idea horizon, get those two right, it generally works a lot better.
So, Greg, the first question that I have for you coming out of, you know, just that's 30 minutes packed full of knowledge and wisdom is that how does the retail investor, how does the average investor begin to even internalize and think about implementing anything that Kyle or John talked about in the past 30 minutes, because it's just so much there.
Yeah, there is. But I think this is a big part of Real Vision is not necessarily trying to spoon feed people trading ideas, but more teach them how very smart, very successful money managers think. And look, here you have two of the best in the business. And as I said in the commentaries, we went through it. You know, Kyle's first question to John was very instructional to me. Now, here's a guy with a great track record, widely acknowledged as one of the best hedge fund managers in the world. And the first question straight in, hi, you know, good to see you. How do you size your positions? And that, to me, as I said, is so important in understanding that if you get that right, a lot of dominoes fall into place the right way. If you get that wrong, you're starting off on the defensive, and it's a crucial thing to get right.
And what struck me too is that John talked about how he understands things from three angles. You think about the top down, the bottom up, and then from the risk manager perspective. And he elaborated on sort of the quantitative side of that, and how he had to learn that, and that changed his view on market structure. And also, he said that in 2009 he didn't even know what QE was. So the nimbleness to learn and adapt, I think it's just that was also evident to me in the interview.
Yeah, it's crucial. I mean, this is a large part of what we're trying to do here. It's the old story about teach a man to fish or give a man a fish, and what we hope to do is teach people to fish instead of just handing them a fish for that one juicy meal. And there was so much in that interview that if you listen to it carefully and you unpack it the right way, it'll teach you to be a great fisherman.
Yeah. Well, I hope the listeners will be coming back to this time and time again, because there's a lot to tease out of there. But coming up next is our Things I Got Wrong segment, where we speak with a market expert about an investing mistake they made, and we try and get them to share those lessons they learned from that experience. And this week's guest is John Netto.
Yeah, I had the great pleasure to interview John in Santa Barbara. Santa Monica. I get my Santas mixed up. Claus is the one that...
He's the one with
the red suit, right?
Yeah.
You know, John's just such a passionate guy, so enthusiastic, and you know, he lives and breathes this stuff. And it was so much fun sitting and talking to him and hearing that passion and that hunger for knowledge come across. And I think you know, a lot of that comes from mistakes that people made. So it was it's great fun talking to him, and it's fun listening in on the lessons he's learned from mistakes.
Yeah, he was a great guy to speak with, and he had some fascinating comments about underpreparing for an important Fed catalyst in 2015. So this week, I'm pleased to be joined by the Protean trader and author of The Global Macro Edge, Maximizing Return Per Unit of Risk, John Netto. John, it's great to have you on, and welcome to the podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, so back in January of this year, you gave an amazing interview on Real Vision. I thought it was great. About trading strategies, about the leveling of the playing field with billionaire traders, and even the innovative ways of looking at performance analysis and risk, and in particular the Netto number. But I want to start with this idea of the protean trader. Now, I'll admit I had to Google the word protean, but I think it's such an appropriate term given your incredibly diverse and adaptive background. So why don't we start there? You know, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and the interesting things you're working on.
My name is John Netto. I am author of the Google Macro Edge, and I'm a cross-asset class trader. I get my living from trading the markets. When you think about my background, the journey plays a big factor in how I am and how I trade the markets and who I am. Having spent almost 9 years in the Marine Corps, having spent, you know, much of my high school and adolescence as an odds maker, facilitating, you know, price and wagers on sporting events. All of these things, both the discipline, both the penchant to take on risk, have influenced who I am and what I do. I trade the markets for a living. I live off my P&L and wrote the book to share my experience and hopefully help others and learn a great deal from that process.
You know, John, that's really interesting. And one of the great things about this segment is that we try and talk to, you know, traders, fund managers, and market experts about their experience and the lessons that they've learned through trading and investing. So, you know, can you tell us a story about a time you made an investing mistake and perhaps an important investing lesson you derived from this experience?
Sure. Going back to 2015, this is a specific example I actually highlighted in the book, because in the book, I had a journal that I basically took a $100,000 risk budget and from January 2010 up until the end of 2015, so over a 6-year time period, and generated over $3.1 million in P&L from that $100,000 risk budget. Well, at the end of that, actually the last quarter, I suffered my biggest drawdown. And I talk about this a little bit in the book, and I provide some more detail on that here. And what had happened is I'd done a good job of trading the Fed and just understanding the message and the policy that had gone on in 2015 with the FOMC, trading their economic releases around in terms of the SEP, the meetings that have every 6 weeks, et cetera. Well, come to October, October 28th or October 29th was a meeting, and I thought that the Fed was going to actually downgrade some of their labor, their perspective of the labor market, given what had just happened recently. And up to that point in time, as the Fed was discussing policy, that this was kind of the last sacred cow. The U.S. labor market was very strong. It had grown, you know, very robustly since 2009. And that downgrade would actually lead to another leg higher in the 5 years and 2 years, and even a rally higher in the euro and potentially gold as well. And so, having, you know, been on a pretty nice run that year, I leveraged myself even more. And this came on the heels of actually going on a trip. And so I hadn't done as much preparation as I normally do before these events. And I rely heavily on my intuition and just my process. And I combine those two really to make what's been a very effective combination of process combined with intuition. And unfortunately, for me, in my position, I lost 3 to 4 months of gains. At that point in time of the year, I was up close to $700,000 in 2015. And I lost 220 of that in about 2 minutes during that Fed release, because I not only decided to press all of my profits that I'd have over the previous months, you know, I thought that upon release of that, when I did look at the statement and did see that the Fed had actually downgraded their labor assessment, that it was worth, you know, adding to my position. Unfortunately, it was also embedded in that language was that a rate hike at the December meeting was all but certain. And having not done the preparation, having not done the preparation I normally did, and maybe being a little more complacent than I was, I just simply took the wrong position and didn't factor in all the market position stuff that I normally did, et cetera. The bottom line is I'm going to do a pretty substantive drawdown, and I could identify two or three different things that contributed to that. One, I didn't do an assessment of myself to say, listen, you've been traveling, you haven't done as much preparation. That should be an automatic trigger that says, okay, you simply can't trade as much. You have to, in essence, put a quantitative score behind where you are in your emotional spectrum or where you are in the balance of your life. The second thing is that I didn't go through my normal contingency plan that, okay, if this comes out, how will you respond? And then grading this event in terms of, all right, what are the five most important things from this economic, from this event, whether it be the market making new highs, a presidential election, FOMC statement, whatever the event is, Anything that can shift a market regime, I go through a process for that, okay? And that process has been further enriched since that Fed meeting in 2015 in October. And so those, not identifying where I was in that emotional spectrum, not identifying that I hadn't done quite the total prep work, and just allowing the P&L of the year to maybe put me in more of a spot of complacency, contributed to that outsized loss. And I didn't react fast enough to cut that off. I didn't react fast enough to make that happen. And that's what transpired.
Yeah, sounds like a perfect storm. I mean, if I was looking forward to vacation, I mean, I guess it's understandable that maybe that would slip. But I want to drill down. When you talk about your process and contingency plans leading into an event like this, you know, can you add a little bit more detail or color to what that process might be like? Or, you know, now after learning from that October 2015 event, how you've carried forward that lesson?
Sure. So I immediately following that event, the first thing, let me talk about specifically, again, I mentioned some of those positions. So I was long, you know, I was long gold. I was long 2 years. I was long 5 years. I was long the euro. These were all things that I expected that with the downgrade of the labor market, that this would all benefit from that. Obviously, when the Fed, in essence, cemented the labor hike, the rate hike, for the December meeting, which was only 6 weeks away, this caught me by surprise, this caught us by surprise, and all those positions not only declined, but declined rather precipitously. So that's, so to provide you the detail, I mean, each one of those chunks, you know, 40 or 50,000 a piece, you know, because they, I mean, if you look at a chart from October 28th, 2015, you'll see markets that are, you know, the 2 years, the 5 years, both, et cetera, and they just sold down immensely. And the great part, the good part in that regard is that I did get out, even though I took a big loss, I didn't stay married to it too much longer. You know, like I was in there and literally within a few minutes I was done. And that actually, those positions, I lost, you know, like I'm saying, 220,000 or so on that day, but would have lost another $500,000 in the following 5 or 6 trading days. So it could have wiped out my gains for the entire year had I decided to like justify something, do something wrong. That being said, moving forward, here's what I did to formalize this, and actually it made its way into the book, which is a great thing. And that is, I built what I call a qualitative self-evaluation. And in a qualitative self-evaluation, I examine 3 things. I examine 1, the preparation that I do. Because for me, 70% of my success comes from the preparation. The 30% is the execution. And intuition is a part of the execution. So I put up a score of a qualitative self-evaluation. And that consists of my preparation, my routine, and my focus. Okay, now the routine would address the travel aspect. All right. You know, in your routine, did you go to the gym yesterday like you normally do? Did you get the right amount of sleep? Did you eat the kind of diet you want? Had you, you know, all the things that you normally do that you encompass before a trade, before a trading day, where are you? Are you at the normal side of that, or are you a little bit outstretched? Have you been traveling, et cetera? And then the focus, like I said, so it's preparation, routine, and focus. The focus is, am I thinking about something other than the market, you know, or something that I normally think outside the market. So am I fighting with my wife? Has my child been sick? Am I going through a particularly stressful time that has me focused on something else? How are my finances? Am I able to pay my bills? You know, all the things that can detract from your focus on the market. And so specifically, because of the pain felt from that Fed event, I formalized and memorialized this qualitative self-evaluation process. And that's outlined in chapter 8 of the book. And that actually came from, the formalization of that came from this specific very painful event. And then I do a postmortem as well. I formalize the postmortem process. And in the postmortem process, I ask myself, okay, how well did I stick to the plan of getting into positions when I wanted, you know, when I wanted to? Did I follow the plan that I laid out in my game plan? Number 2, how well did I manage the positions I was in, okay, based on my game plan? And number 3, is how well did I adapt to what took place given the information? And overall, those are the lessons to put those things in place. And then, you know, 2016, following that, you know, I made back the money I lost on that. In 2016, I had my second best trading year ever. So you see a result. Mistakes were made, inefficiencies in the system, complacency existed. You know, I wasn't my sharpest. It cost me. It is what it is, but I adapted, I corrected it, and I moved on.
You know, John, when I hear that and just in doing this segment, one thing that really strikes me is just when you talk to the great traders and you talk to the fund managers, just the level of self-awareness and self-deconstruction and examination that goes into thorough and professional market speculation is just incredible. And I, you know, listening to you formalize this sort of qualitative self-evaluation, as you call it, is tremendously enlightening. And I hope, you know, some of the listeners, you know, start asking those same questions about themselves and incorporate it into their process. But before we cap things off, can you let our listeners know where to find you and your work, be it online or print?
Sure. You can start by following me on Twitter. It's at John Netto. And then my website is theproteintrader.com. And the Global Macro Edge can be ordered on Amazon on my website at theproteintrader.com. But follow me on Twitter. I'm always tweeting something out about the market at least once a day. Where I think today I tweeted about the FOMC minutes. I try and turn a nugget out, if not once a day, three or four times a week.
Well, great, John. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, Anderson. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, I said going in, John was an enthusiastic and passionate guy, and I think that really came across there. And so, you know, it's interesting that he recognizes that that emotion, that passion is something that he needs to be prepared to evaluate and make sure that doesn't bleed into decision he makes. And I think that's a very useful lesson for people to understand just how your emotions affect your positioning and your decisions you make.
Right. And it really impressed me sort of the emotional self-awareness and the honesty that he has to confront his own emotions and then to then put it down in some sort of empirical or quantitative way to gauge himself in anticipation or leading up to any kind of event such as the Fed raising rates in 2015.
Look, we all get emotional about the Fed, that's for sure.
Well, I don't want to get too emotional, but that brings us to the end of this episode. But before we cap things off, just a quick legal disclaimer. Anything you heard on this episode should not be considered as trading advice. These are our opinions and the opinions of our contributors. So do your fundamental research, chart your technicals, place your stops, and trade responsibly.
Now, next week, we will be back with the usual long-short segment and things I got wrong.
And in our feature documentary, we'll have an in-depth look on volatility. And we're going to seek to dispel some of the myths that are widely misunderstood about this asset class. And we're going to try and get to the root of what it truly means, not only for markets, but for life as well.
Yeah, it's a complicated subject, but I think make sure you tune in next week because I think this affects you a lot more than you realize. In the meantime, if you've got an interesting question about this week's show or anything else for that matter, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email or a voice note at podcast@realvision.com.
And if you enjoyed what you heard, please subscribe on iTunes and please leave us a review. That really helps us shoot up the rankings.
It sure does. I'm not sure how that algorithm works, but it really does. So please take the time. If you want to keep up to date with the latest interviews, research publications, and podcast episodes, then follow us on Twitter at @realvision.
And you'll find us hanging out on Facebook and LinkedIn. Just search for us, Real Vision.
You can follow me on Twitter at @TTMYGH.
And you can follow me at @MacroDidact.
That's it from us.
And we'll see you next week.